National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Number 2. My name is Marvin Herzog, and my respondent is Dr. Sidney Busis. To continue our history, Sid, would you tell us something more about your grandchildren?
My grandchildren? Well, our oldest son, Neil, has three children. He has David, who's named for my father, Annie, who's named for Sylvia's mother, and Hillary, who's named for some relative, I believe, on the other side of the family. And David is 8 years old, and Annie is 7 years old, and Hillary is 4 years old. And my second son, Richard, has three children. His oldest child is Sarah. I mentioned her earlier. She's our first grandchild. She'll be bat mitzvah next year. She was born in 1980, so she's now 12. And her sister, Debbie, is 3 years younger. She's 9. And then Sam was born 1986, so he turned 6 last fall. Those are our 6 grandchildren. 3 in Pittsburgh, 3 in Philadelphia. 2 boys and a girl in each case. 2 girls and a boy, I'm sorry, in each case.
Do you get to see your Philadelphia grandchildren?
Well, we see them, yeah, we see them at holidays, and we have sort of an agreement that Judy's family is rather prominent. That's Rich's wife in Philadelphia. Her mother is Phyllis Beck, who's the Superior Court judge. She was the first woman, the first Jew, I think, in the Superior Court. She's certainly the first woman Jew, female Jew, maybe the first woman. And then she was elected. And Judy's father, Aaron T. Beck, his nickname is Tim Beck, is a renowned psychiatrist who developed something called cognitive therapy that's used all over their cognitive therapy centers. And Judy actually teaches cognitive therapy, and she lectures. In fact, when she was here, she lectured. She lectures all over. And they live in Philadelphia. And their family gets together traditionally on Thanksgiving. So Richie and Judy and those three kids always go to her family for Thanksgiving. The deal is they always come here for Pesach, for the Seder. So we see them at least for the Seder. We see them for other things. Traditionally, over the holiday season, around the turn of the year, we usually meet and spend some time with the children. So we get to see them that way. We talk frequently. We talk, I would say, at least twice a week, maybe even more sometimes.
Tell us something about the ages of your children, Sid.
I can tell you their exact ages. Well, Neil was born in 1951, so he will turn 42. That she's 41 now, and Richard is 2 years younger. He was born in 53, and Jimmy was born in 56. He's 3 years younger than that, and Billy was born in 59. All our children were born in the 50s, which I consider the best 10 years of my life. We lived on Maple Heights Road in a half a double house, in a one-bathroom, little six-room house. It was just wonderful, and we had wonderful time. All the kids grew up there, and everybody was living. You know, it was just nice.
We hear so much about your vaunted Shabbat Friday evening dinner.
Oh, well.
And your family. That's most unusual. Won't you tell us about them?
Well, I don't know that they're vaunted. I know that we enjoy Friday night dinner, and Sylvia, I think, is a wonderful homemaker, and she's really committed, and she loves to cook. She'll spend, you know, a lot of time preparing what we consider a Shabbat meal. And, of course, we light the candles and say the blessings. Neither Sylvia and I drink, so we don't sometimes skip the wine, but the wine blessing, but we do the blessing over the bread. And for a while, you know, things were better when my mother was living and my Uncle Lou was living. They always came. And Neil and his wife, Cindy, and their children used to come. So sometimes we would span, you know, from like 2 or 3 years old up to 96 or 7 years old, because my mother died in December of 19... She died 50 years exactly after Pearl Harbor Day, so that would be December 7th, 1991. She died at 99. And my uncle, Lou Friedman, who was a physician in the same specialty I'm in, he died at 91. A little bit before my mother, actually. At any rate, so we used to have the Shabbat dinner with all of them. Sometimes we'd invite some other people, and it was always very festive. Now, my mother gone, Uncle Lou gone, the only regular we have, aside from immediate family, is my wife's sister, Dorothy, Dorothy Rindberg comes every week. So Dorothy and Neil, and now Neil's separated, so he comes with his children. And so that's what makes up our Friday night contingent, except occasionally we'll invite somebody else. But I find it very comforting just to have that service. And frequently the kids will say the blessings with me, and they'll want to pass out the blessed bread after we say the blessing over the bread. That's about it.
While we're talking about your religious commitment, of course, the Jewish community in Pittsburgh knows about the fact that you are, most recently, the president of Rodef Shalom Temple, and your prior work with the UJF and so on. Won't you tell us about your history with the Jewish organizations in Pittsburgh?
Well, my first contact actually was Jewish Family and Children's Service. That was the first time I became involved, when I was invited to be on the board of Jewish Family and Children's Service. That's when Nate Goodman, who is no longer with us, he was a wonderful man, was the executive director of the JFCS, and that was my first commitment. And I, to this day, have a strong feeling for towards family agency. I think people involved in family agency work are just nice people. And I went on to be president of that agency, and then I got involved nationally with family agencies, and I became president of the national association called the Association of Jewish Family and Children's Agencies, a national organization of all family agencies, and I did a lot of work with them. I'm still on their board as a past president, but frankly, I have not been too active with them recently. And I guess I went on into Federation, getting involved with Physicians Division, chaired the Physicians Division, the campaign, and got involved with campaign committee work, and I can't remember every single detail of that, but I eventually became president of the Federation, and I enjoyed that a lot. Then I became involved nationally in the Council of Jewish Federations. I've served as vice president of the Council of Jewish Federations, and I'm still involved with them. I chair their Personnel Services Committee, which has to do with personnel services on a national basis. And I started out, as you said, or as I said myself, that B'nai Israel, but my wife's family always went to Temple, so when we got married in 1947, I sort of switched over to Temple, and I find Temple very gratifying. First of all, I see nothing wrong with praying in a language you understand. I think a lot of times praying in a language you don't understand is mumbo-jumbo, and I think when you pray in something that you really know what you're saying, I think it has more meaning. And I've enjoyed Temple a lot. I think that we've always had scholarly rabbis and always learned at Temple. And so I was privileged to serve as president, as you said, and I thought that was a very exhilarating experience. I've been involved nationally with other organizations. I'm on the board of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which is the organization that receives UJA funds to help needy Jews throughout the world. I'm on the board of JES, the Jewish Educational Service of North America, which is an organization dealing with Jewish education on a national level. And I don't know, I have to look at my CV. That's all I can think of right now.
It's a well-known truism that if you want to get something done, see a busy man. I think that you exemplify though that particular saying. How in the world you maintain one of the busiest medical practices in the city and do all of this extracurricular work is a mystery that those of us who would like to think that we're your friends wonder about. How in the world do you find time for all of these things?
Well, I think that you sort of have to categorize your thinking. In other words, I do a lot of teaching. I hold a rank of clinical professor of otolaryngology in the School of Medicine. I've taught throughout my career, and I've had residents and so forth in my office from time to time in the past, not recently. And I've directed a number of courses about the ear. I'm doing some writing. In fact, right now I'm writing two chapters for books. And I still give courses at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. And I think what you have to do is categorize your thinking and sort of compartmentalize things. In other words, I can, if I have to give a talk or do something for, say, the community federation or temple or something like that, and give a lecture, I can prepare the lecture, and as soon as it's prepared, switch over to something else and do something else. For example, Sylvia sometimes has commented on this, we'll fly someplace, and I work on planes well, by the way, and we'll fly someplace, I'm working on a course that I'm giving, the slides and the whole business, and on the way back, put that aside and you think of something else. So you have to really, you can't, you know, dwell on what you've done. You got to finish your job and move on to the next one. And then, of course, I think I fall down on this. You have to have good filing systems. My systems aren't that great, but they're not that bad. But you have to know where things are.
Well, you're entirely a remarkable person. And we're very proud of you. Your connection with the University of Pittsburgh, is that a daily stint?
With the...
Your teaching commitment.
No, it's not daily at all. Mm-mm. It used to be much more than it is now. Don't forget, I've been in practice now a long time. I started out in 1951, and this is now 1993, so I've been in practice now for 42 years, and many of my patients say to me, Doctor, you're retiring soon, you know. So you get to the stage where other people take over, and whereas I used to be intimately involved with the residency training program, not anymore. I used to, for example, for years, run the otology conference once a month, had to prepare for that and so forth. So that things do, I think, fortunately, they sort of taper off. So I'm not involved nearly as much in teaching as I used to be, but years ago I was very much involved in teaching.
Are you in association with some other doctors as well?
Nope, I've always been in private practice. I started out in practice with my uncle, Dr. Louis Friedman, in the Jenkins Arcade, and I was with him for a few years. And I guess I wanted to spread my wings, and the doctor in Oakland died, and his office was available, and so two other doctors, an internist and I took this office over, and I moved out to Oakland. Then for about two or three years, I used to run between downtown and Pittsburgh, but I was busy building up this practice. At one point, I had an office in East Pittsburgh. I also had an office in Russellton, Pennsylvania, and I used to run around a lot. And that's how I built up this practice. And then over the years, a number of people have approached me about coming into practice with me, but I always felt I wanted to be my own boss, because just as we've been talking, I like to be able to go to meetings and things like that, and I never wanted to have to account to anybody. So it's worked out okay. And the other thing that helped me a lot was having my association with the university, because being involved in teaching, I never hesitated if there was an emergency to have them go to the emergency room, because I knew the resident take care of them, because I had a very close relationship with the residents. I couldn't have done it if I had been in some small town all by myself without any backup. So that was the saving thing for me. And now I wouldn't mind having someone come in, but now this specialty is becoming so hot and popular that it's difficult to find anybody, frankly.
You're such an articulate person. Have you thought at all about extending your career doing consultations and lecturing and that sort of thing, and giving up your practice?
Well, these always come to mind, but whether you want to give up your practice, we just came back from 3 weeks in Sarasota, and you wonder, I said to Sylvia, you know, some people are swimming this morning, and we're not going to be swimming this morning. No, I've never thought, I have anything to offer in a lecture tour, frankly. I do some consulting. That's the interesting thing you brought up. I've been very involved and interested in hearing conservation, for example. And I went and took a course and became a certified occupational hearing conservationist, which is something that people do when they go out the mills to test hearing. You know, I could do that officially. I don't want to do it, but I just want to know how they do it. So I did that, and I've been involved in hearing consultations and hearing conservation, rather, and I've served as a consultant to a steel company in helping them set up their hearing conservation program. So I have an ongoing relationship with them, and in my practice I'm involved in compensations, hearing loss compensation cases somewhat, so that I feel that that would be like a sort of like a little subspecialty, if you wish.
Yeah. To switch the subject for a moment, have you given very much thought to the situation that Jews find themselves in presently in this dangerous world of ours? Would you care to comment about the future of the of Israel and the future of Jews in the diaspora?
Well, something I think about all the time. I think that's one of the things that drives me as far as working for the congregation, working with the Federation, and working for Jesna and so forth. Yes, I'm very driven by that. First of all, I think we have responsibility. I believe we have a glorious heritage, a wonderful past, and I think we have a bright future. And I think that those of us who are living today are the link in this chain between the past and the future, and I think we have responsibility to do everything we can to assure the future for our children and grandchildren. That's the way I feel. And as far as my outlook is concerned, I learned a lot from Dr. Freehoff, may he rest in peace. I've saved some of his sermons, and I remember one in particular, he talked about what the Jews have contributed to the world. And he mentioned at least three things, and one had to do with the concept of brotherhood. There's one God in all mankind. For all mankind, all men are brothers. And that was one concept. Before that, pagans worshipped idols, multiple gods, and so forth. So the concept of monotheism is one of the contributions of Judaism to the world. And another is the concept of mercy, taking in the stranger. Before this Jewish concept came to be, strangers were killed. They were considered enemies. They were considered hostile. And that leads to the whole concept of hospitals and brotherhoods and so forth. And then the third concept was the concept of hope. Dr. Freehoff always, the messianic concept. Dr. Freehoff said the Greeks always said that the glory that had been, and the Jews say, what is to come, what will be. And so that I think that we as Jews, at least I as a Jew, have this hope. It may be foolish at times, but even in my personal life and my family life, if we have some problem with family life, I've always taught my children somehow it's going to turn out okay. At least that's my philosophy. And I think the Jews are under pressure. I think we're in trouble because of assimilation. In our marriage, I think we are in trouble. But I'm hopeful that we will prevail, and I think that we will. I think it's very important that Israel survive. I think it's very important for Israel to survive, and that's why I'm so committed to, you know, to supporting the state of Israel. And I think the diaspora is very important. Israel learned that in the Six-Day War. They learned that the only ones they could depend on immediately were the Jewish communities in the diaspora around the world. And I think that we have to maintain a strong local community. So I, for one, don't, for example, feel that I have to make Aliyah to Israel to preserve Judaism. I think it's important for some of us to be here to keep something strong here so we can support the state.
Do you care to comment on our present situation here in this country with the advent of skinheads and neo-Nazis and that sort of thing? Have you had any experience in that regard at all?
I haven't any personal experience. I started to say earlier, I think, at least to myself, I started to say that this goes back to my childhood. My father was very committed to Judaism, even though he was not like a practicing Jew like my mother was. My mother had a kosher home, and she was very devout, but my father was sort of, he would laugh off his sleeve a little bit sometimes at some of the things we did, but nonetheless, he was committed to the preservation of Judaism. And in 1933, he was very concerned about the advent of Hitler, when Hitler came into power. And he and his buddies went over to the North Side one time to break up a brown shirt meeting of Nazis in the North Side. And I remember going with him and throwing a brick through a window and so forth. So that I go away back a long time as far as having this concern about and perhaps fear about skinheads and Nazis and so forth. And I've been haunted by the Holocaust, really. I might tell you that. I served as chairman of the Holocaust Commission here for 5 years. We were just developing the Holocaust Center and the commission and learned a lot about it. One of our campaign tools to raise money for the Holocaust Commission was a slide presentation, about a 20-minute slide presentation put together by Isaiah Cooperstein, who at the time was the director of the Holocaust Center, on Auschwitz. And I just think of that sometimes. I wake up and shiver. I mean, it's just unbelievable what went on in the Holocaust. So that I do have this concern about the survival of Judaism and what can happen to us. And of course, I'm concerned about the skinheads and the religious right and the Farrakhans in this country. And I just think that we have to be strong, and I think we have to learn that we can't be passive. We have to be active. And I think we have to become political. And I don't think it's wrong for us to have an AIPAC American Israel Public Affairs Committee that's a lobby for Israel. I think it's good for us to have that. No one's going to appreciate you when you're weak. I think you have to be strong.
Sid, perhaps you can tell us about your siblings. I'd like to know their names and what they do and so on.
My one sister, Jean, who's married to Harvey Solomon. They were married on February the 1st, 1948. They have three children. Their oldest son, Kenny, is an attorney in Washington. Their second son, Edward, has his own business in Pittsburgh. He's in the sound business, but puts in sound systems and that sort of thing. He's an electrical engineer. And their third son, Donald, is a computer scientist. He's a PhD in computer science. He studied at the University of Texas, and he's back in Pittsburgh now, setting up a computer science department at Duquesne University. He's married to a young woman named Lee, and then they have children that recently married. The oldest son, Kenny, has three children. Kenny is married to Janet Hahn, whose parents are Pittsburghers, Claire and Jerry Hahn, and they have three children. They have two girls and a boy, Eliza, Jessica, and Zachary. And my sister was a wonderful school teacher. She taught kindergarten and first grade in Pittsburgh public schools for a long time. She retired about 2 years ago, and they're spending more time now in Florida in the winter, but not in the summer. My sister's very gregarious. She's sort of like my father was. She is like the Pearl Mesta wherever she is.
And is she the oldest?
No, I'm the oldest. She's okay. 5 years younger than I am. But I had two older brothers, by the way. I'm not my mother's first child. She had twin boys who were a few years older than I am. They didn't live. They died in very early infancy. I suspect in today's world they would have lived, but in those days they didn't.
So there were...
Just two of us.
So there's just the two of you. I'm interested to know about your opinion of health care in Pittsburgh as opposed to health care in other cities. Do you feel that we are on a par with or superior to larger cities in the country?
Well, it depends how you look at it. If you're talking about the quality of health care, I think we're way ahead of most cities. We have, you know, some of the finest physicians and highest technology in the city, in the country, rather. We're like the leading transplant center, I think, in the world, at least one of them. I don't know statistics about how many people have health insurance and things of that nature. I can't answer that question. I suspect, like in every community, we have our own homeless, and we have our own indigents who don't have health insurance, so that's a big problem. I know that when the mill shut down, we saw a lot of people who lost their insurance. It's a big issue. But I think that the quality is certainly good, and whether the distribution is as good as it should be, I frankly would have my doubts.
We have a fine reputation, undoubtedly, at least in the Pittsburgh area. But we hear about people who go off to Mayo and to Cleveland Clinic and so on. Is that a viable alternative to the kind of service that we have here in Pittsburgh?
Well, that's sort of like personal choice. There are some people, first of all, the grass is always greener. Some people think it's better if it's not in Pittsburgh. And some people want to follow the mystique. There's no question the Mayo Clinic has a mystique that we can't match. The Cleveland Clinic the same way. And the Cleveland Clinic were pioneers in the early days of thyroid surgery. Now they've been the pioneers and one of the leaders in cardiac surgery. And I know many people go there for cardiac surgery or open heart surgery as well as grafts and so forth. I think you get it done as well in Pittsburgh. If you ask me what I would do, I can't honestly answer that because it's an individual decision. When you're faced with it, of course, you want to do what you think is best. But I would say, honestly, I don't think people have to leave the city to go elsewhere, but I think that they do because they think it's better.
To your recollection, your life as a youngster, as a child, Where did you play? Did you play around your own neighborhood, or did you go to some kind of a nursery school, do you recall?
I don't recall going to nursery school. I think in our day there weren't any nursery schools that I know. I went to kindergarten, I know that. We lived at the corner of Hayes and Chislett, which was a pretty Jewish neighborhood in those days. In fact, a lot of people became very prominent in the city, lived on Hayes Street, like the Shapiros and the Weisbergs and a whole bunch of other people who were older than I don't remember them all. But I remember going to Rogers School, I think I mentioned this before, in kindergarten, and we had a fairly nice house at the corner of Hayes and Chisholm Street, rather large yard there, and I remember playing in the yard. An interesting anecdote about my play up there was that we had an alley behind our house between Hayes Street and Baywood, which is next street. There's an alley which had a rather steep slope, and in those days we used to use scooters a lot. I remember scooters not, but we used to have scooter races down the island, down the alley, and the kid who lived on the other side of the alley, his name, a kid named Aitzi, and I used to play with Aitzi, and we were very fast friends. And then we moved. And just to finish that story, years later, after I was a physician, when I finished my residency, I was very much involved in the early Salk business. I did all the tracheotomies for Jonas Salk in the early days, went to Municipal Hospital. I was scared to death because we had two small children then, and I would come home and the kids would grab me. I was sure they were getting polio because I was up there getting, you know, infected, I thought, spit on and all that with these sick patients, very, very sick patients. That's another story. But anyhow, so we wrote a paper on polio in Western Pennsylvania, and I was one of the authors. And I showed it to my father with some pride. He looked at her and said, "Oh," I said, "you grew up with him." I said, "What do you mean, H.C. Mansman Jr., you grew up with him?" I said, "I did? I never knew that." And he didn't know it either. His name was H.C. Mansman Jr. His parents owned Mansman's department store in East Liberty in Pittsburgh. And his name was H.C. Mansman Jr. He was a kid, we called him, I guess this family called him H.C. I called him H.C., I don't know. And I never, ever connected it until my father told me that many years later. And then I told Herb, we called him Herb, that Herb Mansman about it. He was surprised, too. In other words, we played together as kids and didn't realize it until my father looked at that and said, "Oh, you grew up with him." That's an interesting story.
So Morningside was a...
No, I wasn't Morningside. Morningside was different. Morningside. No, Morningside was different. We were scared to death of kids at Morningside. They were tough. We were. Now, you see, where we were, we called it, I don't know what we called it. We called it just East Liberty, I guess. But Morningside and Sunnyside were different. They were up Stanton Avenue, up on the hill. And then when we moved, we were more or less, I guess you would say, in the Highland Park District. We moved down near the drugstore. And there we used to have wonderful times. We played on Portland Street. We used to play box ball. And we could play box ball for hours and never see a car in those days. But every now and then when a car would be parked, we'd go and ask if they could move it so we could play box ball. Today, I sometimes, just for nostalgic purposes, drive down the streets just jammed with cars. But box ball was a game we drew. Actually, we used paint to have permanent lines. Drew two lines across the street, you know, about, I don't know, 50 feet or 40 feet, whatever. In other words, to make a box. And we painted the bases in, and it was like a little field. And we played with a soft rubber ball. You pitched it underhanded, had it bounce once, and you hit it with an open hand. Hit the ball on a fly outside the box, you were out. So the idea was hit it on the ground inside the box, and it ruled just like baseball.
Did you play stickball in those days?
Never played stickball. But I had an interesting experience playing box ball one time. I was coming in from third base, and the kid was coming in from the pitcher or something, and I ended up unconscious. I hit my head on a tree. And I can remember that vividly, coming to in my parents' bed with the room spinning around. And I guess they were quite frightened that Tom was unconscious for a while.
So later on, were you sports-minded also? Did you follow Pittsburgh teams, for example?
I was never much of an athlete.
I see.
We used to get down to, we used to play on the field up around Highland Park. We used to play sometimes, a place called Hethfield, which is Hethfield, H-E-T-H-S, which was the end of Highview Street. We used to play on Highview Street sometimes. It was a Highview Street gang. I mean, honestly, I mean it in a nice sense.
Group?
A group, yes. There was one kid who, I guess I should mention his name, who won all the marbles all the time, went on to great heights in the business world.
Well, do you, even these days, do you follow the the welfare of the Pittsburgh Steelers, for example, and the Pittsburgh Pirates.
I'm totally a Pittsburgher, you know, and I love the teams. I think it's good for Pittsburgh. And now I'm not a maven about sports. I never was a very good athlete, frankly. The best thing I do is swim. And first golf I thought was sort of a waste of time, just too much time. I belong to a country club. We still do, but I don't play golf, but we go out, it's like 4 or 5 hours. I played a lot of tennis in college, but somehow I didn't keep it up. My big thing in high school was chess. I was pretty good at chess. In fact, when I was at Peabody, we won the city chess championship for the whole